That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. Happy Christmas, Danny.
Happy Christmas and a Merry New Year's to you.
And happy Christmas to all of our listeners. How's everything going, man? How are you?
Chilling, man. I finally snagged an apartment for rent, so I think this is going to be the last time where I'm recording in some strange condition. I'm in an Airbnb right now, and there's no desk, so what I did was I hooked up my computer to the TV, and I pushed the couch like super close to it, so I'm just like chilling on a couch. But it's actually really quiet in here, so I think the audio is going to sound pretty good. So Anyway, I'm excited to not have to have like a real setup again and get back to business, get back on track, on schedule, regular releases.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, so last episode that we recorded was kind of like a disaster as far as putting that thing together. I know that you were editing that.
It was
so
hard.
Because both of us were recording in just like weird-ass places. I was recording on a Pilates machine in Chicago.
Yep, and I was in a closet.
I was in a closet, literally in a closet.
And you were in a closet. There's this guy who lives at my aunt's place, which is where I was posted up for the recording. And it's just this older gentleman. His name's Giuseppe, and he was having some very loud phone conversations outside, but like so loud,
yeah, I heard him
hear it, you know. So apologies in advance for his conversations, but you know, I can't tell a guy to not have his conversations. So
shut the fuck up! I'm podcasting here.
No, I think that'll be the last time that happens.
Yeah, so I think we're kind of finalizing our spree of like ghetto ass setups as far as recording is concerned. I'm back home in my normal recording environment. So, I mean, I think we'll be good. And you know, you're about to, you know, congratulations, by the way, and finally finding a place. Well, I guess kind of halfway there, finding a place, right, in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't purchased something yet. You know, cross your fingers for me, guys. You know, I'm in the process of actually buying something, but right now we went ahead and just rented a place for 6 months just so we can get, you know, some stability in our lives. And the rent is pretty cheap and it's a nice apartment. So, you know, hopefully that'll just give me some peace of mind while we work on this forever stuff. So, yeah. Thank you, man.
Well, is rent cheaper than New York rent? I'm assuming that, right? If you're saying it's cheap.
Yeah, dude. Yes. That, like, considerably cheaper. Let's say like 60% cheaper than New York.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, that doesn't seem so bad to me. You're in a beautiful location. You're paying a lot lower of rent. You're making a New York salary, basically.
Yeah.
It sounds like you have a pretty good setup. And then the sizing of the size of the place is good, too.
Yeah, it's twice as big as my last apartment in New York. And I really liked my last apartment in New York. So, you know, it's going to give us more than enough room. But now the trouble that we have is like, okay, we're probably going to have a pretty empty apartment for a while because, you know, we're in the process of buying something, so I don't want to buy furniture for one place and then it not fit or like not go with the new place. You know what I mean? So that's something to think about. But you know, we'll start small and we'll get there.
Well, you know what? Maybe I'll go to Puerto Rico I miss you already, by the way. I wish you were still. You know, I'm kind of sad that you're not close to me because we were only about a half hour. I mean, it took me about a half hour to get to your apartment from my place
on a
in
bicycle.
Park Slope to Bushwick. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna miss you. Maybe I'll come to Puerto Rico for my bachelor party.
Dude, you're more than welcome to whatever you like. I'll have an extra room if you need it. So,
yeah, I mean it'll be like 7 or 8 guys. I wouldn't want to invite that many people to your house. But
well, we could get like one of those like swanky Airbnbs. You know,
I'd want to get one of those because you know I've been trying to plan my bachelor party, and mm-hmm. a lot of my friends So like my friends are kind of dictating it more than what I want. You know, I wanted to do some hiking trip. Got into like just hiking over the past couple of years. And like this summer I did like a big trip to Mount Washington, which was a lot of fun. And I want to do something like that in the Northeast that's easy. But my problem is that most of my friends will die on a hiking trip. Like most of my buddies, well, half my buddies would love it. And then half, my other half are, would have heart attacks on their way up, like up a mountain.
Well,
so I think we're going to have to roll that out.
Can I interest you in something here in Puerto Rico that I've done before? It's something called canyoneering, and it's like hiking.
Canyoneering.
Canyoneering. It's like hiking, water fording, and rappelling, and sometimes ziplining. So basically, there's a whole fucking rainforest mountain called El Yunque here in Puerto Rico, and it's gorgeous, right? There's no like predators or anything dangerous out there, so it's fine. So you basically hike through the jungle, which is cool, and it's really scenic and beautiful. And then there's some rivers and stuff, and you walk through the rivers, and sometimes you like do rappelling down the waterfalls, and sometimes you do some zip lining and stuff like that. But it's like basically hiking and walking through rivers and shit like that. It's so much fun. Actually, I think you'd like it if you like hiking.
Dude, that actually sounds awesome. That actually sounds like that might be something higher on my list. Like my buddies are trying to convince me. They were trying to convince me to do Amsterdam because I did an Amsterdam trip a couple of years ago. And I love Amsterdam. It is my favorite city in the entire world.
Yeah.
But like all the COVID stuff, I don't think it's really worth traveling outside of the country. They were also trying to convince me to go to Dublin, if not Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, again, I'm happy with doing a hiking trip. So. if you're saying it's like fun hiking and like a place that people want to go to, that might be what I do.
It's cool, man, and you don't need a passport or anything like that.
I have a translator.
You know, you don't even need me. I don't speak English here.
I can kind of understand Spanish a little bit, but I'm not good. I'm horrible with languages. All right. So let's just I could get to the episode. So this is kind of a part three in our, or I think this episode will stand alone as its own episode. So I don't think you have to feel pressure to go listen to the other two episodes on the breakup of Yugoslavia that we did, because I do think this will stand alone as its own thing. However, it is kind of part three of the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Yep.
So about a couple weeks ago, we did an episode on just like a high-level overview of Yugoslavia, the rise and fall of it, the breakup of all the different republics. And then the follow-up episode to that, we did it on the Bosnian War. So in the secession of Bosnia from Yugoslavia and the war that happened and the ultimate intervention from NATO. And we obviously left a lot of things out because it's such a complicated mess. You know, it's the Balkanization of a region is always going to be really complicated, and there's going to be so many different sides of the story. So we were kind of narrowing it down to Bosnia last episode. And people have said to me, well, why don't you talk about Kosovo? Well, because Kosovo, it would have been really, it would have been more confusing if we included, you know, the ethnic sectarianism against in Kosovo between, you know, the Albanians and the Serbs there. And so we try to kind of zero it down on just Bosnia. And on this episode, we're going to focus on Kosovo and the ultimate intervention in 1999 by NATO. And it's going to sound, you know, as we go through this, you know, we're going to go over familiar history, so things that we've talked about. But I guess we're going to try to hit this in a different angle and strictly cover the ethnic crisis between Serbs and Albanians and Kosovo.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And I just wanted to make one remark mentioned to you just before we started recording, and that's that, you know, after, you know, doing all these episodes on, you know, the Balkans, I think I really, really like it. It's helping me to understand geopolitics better, because I feel like, you know, this whole Balkans region over the last 40 years has encountered pretty much every like trope that we've covered on this show. I mean, I'm talking about like changing political dynamics, like going from communism to, you know, capitalism, or, you know, elements of the Cold War, or, you know, World War II, World War I, you know, ethnic divides, other sectarian divides, religious divides, like, you know,
NATO
like
interventions,
NATO expansion, like like all of this shit that we talk about on the show, I feel like those themes.
Terrorism.
I forgot about terrorism. Yeah.
And then we're going to get into organ trafficking later too in this episode.
Oh yeah. Well, that's something even, I don't even think we've touched on that very much on the show, but yeah. still super crazy. And I just think that this region is so fascinating, and I knew very little about it before we started, you know, doing the research on it. And I'm so happy that we did it, because I feel like this is like a good, you know, reference point now for when we cover other regions and other conflicts, because we can use this as a reference point, you know, for other regional instabilities.
Yeah, you know, I think you can learn a lot of lessons here in Yugoslavia when it comes to looking at the Middle East, when it comes to looking at Russia, when it comes to looking at, I mean, even in America right now with all the talk of potential Balkanization. So, you know, I guess I'll just get back. Should I start with just like the early history of it and start yeah. from there? And then I'm not going to do as an extensive overview of the early history of the region on the as in previous episodes, but just kind of like the quick synopsis, so you know we could kind of set up the future conflict or the conflict at that place that ultimately takes place in the late 90s. So real quick, the lands that made up Yugoslavia going back thousands of years were part of the Roman Empire. It was called the province of Illyricum, and Serbs and other Slavic tribes migrated into the Balkans around the 6th century or so. So Serbian historians at this time, they say that there is no Albanians living in Kosovo. And what Albanian historians say is that Albanians are the descendants of the ancient Illyrians of the region who are in Greek texts and whatnot.
Okay, so that sounds a lot to me like all of the ancient histories that try to point back to one direct lineage, like the Chinese or like the Japanese and things like that. Is this true?
I have no clue. So it's I have absolutely no idea if that is true or not, or how, if you know, the Albanians today can trace their lineage back to the ancient Illyrians there, or you know, if there's actually firm evidence that, you know, the South Slavics that settled there are the descendants. You know, maybe it could be true. You know, you'd have to really ask somebody who's an historian who has a specialty in this time period and you know, the ancient world and migrations of humans. You know, this is just what historians are saying, and a lot of times history is used for used for the state or for nationalistic purposes.
Right. You know, everybody wants to stake a claim to a particular patch of ground. You know,
yeah.
And the way that they do it is like, oh, I was here since fucking Moses times, you know, like I was here since forever. So
exactly, you know, we have our great ancestors were here since for 5,000 years. Right. You know, they had an ancient kingdom there, and we're the descendants of that ancient kingdom, and you know, all that stuff. It gets very hazy as you go further and further back. Maybe it's true. Maybe there's somebody who's listening to this right now. It's like, fuck you guys. I know
everybody's
got to
come from somewhere.
My great. What's that?
Everybody's got to come from somewhere, right? So it's yeah. equally possible.
I have an idea of what my ancestry is. So, you know, I just tell people I'm Irish and Polish. Irish on my mom's side and Polish on my dad's side. But my dad's side, who was Polish, they were Poles from Kiev. Who they lived in Kiev, they were Poles there, and then they were forced out during the Soviet my grandfather was super old. He was born in 1910 and had my father late in his life, so he was an old father. So he was born in 1910. If he was still alive, he'd be like 100 and something. 112. He was a Ukraine, he lived in Ukraine, his family was based in Kiev, and then his property was seized during the Bolshevik Revolution, and he moved to France as a 9-year-old. So, you know, it gets kind of weird on that line too. I could even say, hey, listen, like I'm the my descendants own this property. You know, imagine if like I went back and that old estate that they lived in was used as like a multifamily house where a bunch of people lived there. And I was like, my grandfather lived in this house. It's mine now. All you guys are evicted. Like that would just be insane,
imagine.
Right? I mean, that's getting a little off the point. And let's just fast forward real quick for, you know, just so we can get to the conflict, because we have a lot to cover.
Okay.
So in the late 12th century, there was this great Serbian king named King Nemanja, and he conquered Kosovo from the Eastern Roman Empire. Kosovo becomes the center of the Serbian state, and Serbia reaches its zenith, its medieval zenith, under King Stefan Dušan in the 1300s, and, you know, they create this great Serbian empire, and it includes all of Kosovo, northern Albania, Macedonia, and then a lot of Greece. And what eventually happens is that the Serbian empire, it starts to decline due to the squabbling among Stefan Dušan's successors, and they're eventually swallowed up by the Ottoman Empire. You know, we spoke about this a bunch already, but, you know, the Battle of Kosovo, you know, the Serbs are defeated by the Turks, and, you know, most of the stories surrounding the Battle of Kosovo, they seem more to be mythology rather than history. You know, historians even say, you know, between Serbian and Albanian historians, a lot of them even say that they were fighting each other during this battle. You know, the Albanians there were Ottoman proxies and stuff like that. So The Serbs were actually, you know, this ethnic conflict goes back centuries, you know, back to the 1300s. You know, once again, I have no clue if this is true or not. You know, you'd have to consult with a historian who most likely specializes in this region. Nevertheless, the Battle of Kosovo is you know, it's very significant to Serbian national identity. The day is celebrated as St. Vitus Day, and you know, we went over this as well. A lot of notable events in Serbian history fall on this day, which is June 28th. So on 1876, Serbia declared war on the Ottoman Empire, which led to their independence. Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated on June 28th, 1914. And then there's a lot of other, you know, special events or important events in Serbian history that fall on the date June 28th. Now, in 1689, Austrian forces, they temporarily seize Kosovo from the Ottomans. And local Serbs end up joining forces with them to fight the Turks. However, they end up losing the war, and this causes a massive flux of refugees from Kosovo to Hungary. And then there was another Austrian expedition in Kosovo in the year 1737, where the same exact thing basically happens. The local Serbs join with the Austrians, they fight, they lose, and then there is a forced migration.
Right.
So Serbian historians, they claim that the shift from a predominantly Serbian population in Kosovo to a mainly ethnic Albanian population, it begins at this time. Albanians, they allegedly migrate from, you know, the poor mountainous regions of northern Albania into the more fertile plains of Kosovo. You know, other historians are saying that this shift started much earlier and it occurred more gradually. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think these things really matter when it comes to the, you know, the current conflicts. Now,
I think it just sounds like a lot of people were moving around in this particular region, just, like a whole lot.
It does, and I'm sure there's truth to people being expelled from the city, because, you know, there's in European history, forced migrations was something that was pretty common.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there absolutely was, but I'm sure there was just, you know, there's a lot of reasons why people migrate from one place to another. So what's important to note is that the Albanians in Kosovo, the majority of them, they convert to Islam.
Right.
Although
there is still a largely Roman Catholic minority that exists mostly in that northwest of Kosovo region.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason why, it's important to note the reason why a lot of people converted to Islam, they took place to avoid a jizya. And a jizya is a tax on non-Muslims.
Jizya, I barely even know ya. Sorry, I had to. I feel like, you know, contrary to popular belief, though, most Muslim empires weren't like fanatical in terms of killing non-Muslims. You know, they often just wanted, you know, natives to stick around because they can tax them, and, you know, they didn't want those natives to convert because it would hurt their tax base. But just wondering out loud here, I wonder if having that special tax on non-Muslims actually unintentionally creates the conditions by which so many ethnic Albanians end up converting. Maybe we could say that taxation is actually the root of all of the conflict here. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, if you look at even the Arab Empire, a lot of parts of the Arab Empire, because, you know, when the Arab Empire actually conquers Northern Africa, mm-hmm. most people don't convert to Islam. And right. it was because the bureaucracy, the people who are running it, understood that their tax base would be shrunken. It would evaporate. So right.
They still had jizya.
Ruled over a very like a lot of Christians, and they ruled over a lot of pagans, like a lot of the northern, a lot of the you know communities in Northern Africa were not yet Muslim yet. That Muslim transition comes actually a lot later. Islamization. I suck at saying words. There's more people convert to Islam in the Ottoman Empire. Islamization.
Yeah.
During the Ottoman Empire than the actual Arab Empire. Mm-hmm. That's why. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, well, maybe you could just tell us a bit more about the region under the Ottoman rule, because that's the important bit for this.
Yeah, so in the early 1800s, parts of Serbia near Belgrade became semi-autonomous within the Ottoman Empire. If you look at Serbian history for, you know, throughout the 1800s, it's like this, it's actually really, really chaotic. Like, there's a bunch of different kings who are assassinated. They all have different loyalties, and they're all kind of like puppets to different empires, and it's a real mess. And we've covered this in our World War I episodes, because a lot of it has to do with the lead up to it. But to give you the long story, to make a long story short, in 1833, Serbia received full autonomy in more territory as a result of an agreement reached with the Ottomans under Russian pressure. The Russian Empire always kind of had camaraderie with the southern Slavs in the Balkan regions, and mm-hmm. Serbia kind of saw them as like their big brother, so they would actually negotiate on behalf of them in a lot of conflicts. However, Kosovo remained in Ottoman hands until the Russian-Turkish War, which Russia wins. So Russia imposed the Treaty of San Stefano, which created a Greater Bulgaria and assigned parts of what is now Kosovo to Serbia and Montenegro. Now, ethnic Albanians obviously didn't like this. You know, they are the majority there at this point. And in response, Albanian leaders formed the League of Prizren on June 18th, 78. June 1878, with the aim of consolidating Albanian inhabited lands into one province within the Ottoman Empire. They were calling this a Greater Albania.
All right. So, side note, what's up with this like Greater Albania, Greater Serbia, Greater insert country name here? Like, it just, I don't know. It just sounds like everyone in the region wants more and more, right? And they want to expand, and they want to make claims on more things. And every time I hear this, like, greater insert country name, I get, like, this bad taste in my mouth. Am I like, nuts, or am I onto something?
No, it's you hear that phrase a lot, like greater Israel, for example, you mm-hmm. hear a lot. Greater Serbia. I guess it can mean different things. I guess the most common way it's used is just like a country that its influence expands upon its actual like national borders mm-hmm. to the regions that are close by. But I guess it also could include like you know, a sovereign nation state that also governs the nearby diasporas that are the diaspora of that nation state that are not actually in that nation state. It could just mean to expand your borders to cover wherever your diaspora reaches. So in the context of like a greater Serbia, the way that they were talking was that, you know, they wanted to expand their borders to everywhere they were. The language that was used was anywhere a Serb lives is Serbia, meaning that, you know, Serbs were spread out everywhere, not just in Serbia. They were
anywhere there was
Croatia,
a church.
They were wherever exactly. Whatever there was an Eastern Orthodox church, because a lot of it was broken down by religion in that region too. You know, the Serbs were Eastern Orthodox, the Albanians and Bosnians were Muslims, Croatians were Catholic, Slovenians were Catholic, and so a lot of it was kind of broken down by a sectarian divide as well. So that was the language that they were using. They were saying, hey, wherever there is an Eastern Orthodox church, that's Serbia. Wherever there's a Serb, that's Serbia. So that's kind of the context of how they use the greater. I think in like the context of greater Israel, I guess the way that they use it is that wherever they can find like old Jewish temples and things like that, or old synagogues, or artifacts of where they can see that the ancient Israelites used to live would be considered Israel.
One comparison that I saw, and this is relevant for Kosovo and Israel, is that Kosovo is like Serbia's Jerusalem. And that's why they don't want to recognize Kosovo as a thing right now. They've got history there. And that's why this particular conflict is so kind of hard to navigate, because they do legitimately have a long history there, but also, you know, the demographics don't make sense anymore, and or probably never made any sense in the first place. And, you know, like, they don't want to give up what they think was historically theirs, and, you know, that might not reflect the realities on the ground today, or even the realities on the ground for several hundred years. You know, it's just weird. It's a weird situation.
Yeah, and in the case of the Serbians, if you want to play the identity politics game, Serbians are a group of people that have been abused a lot by the Ottoman Empire. Before the Ottomans, the Eastern Romans, the Ottoman Empire, and then obviously the Nazis in World War II. So they do actually have a lot of historic gripes, and you can understand why nationalism will form there, where hardcore nationalism will form there. And you can also understand why these nationalist movements would form among the Albanian population there as well.
Right.
Because, for similar reasons. And when you favor one group, it forces the other group to band together and to compete with the opposing nationalism and nationalistic movements that, may be harmful to them. But where was I? Congress of Berlin, I think. Right?
Yeah.
Or I was about to get into the Congress of Berlin. So
took us on a
of Berlin. So big conference with all the European powers. This takes place in July of 1878. I guess one of the main, a lot of borders and things were drawn during this conference. But as it relates to Kosovo, a lot of the greater powers were alarmed at Russia's gains in the region in their previous wars. So they end up forcing a reduction in the size of Bulgaria. And then they took Albanian inhabited lands away from Serbia and Montenegro and gave them back to the Turks. However, Serbia had been permitted to keep other territories they had seized. The Congress of Berlin is actually when Serbia received its formal independence from the Ottoman Empire.
That's right.
Now, in October 1912, Serbia, Montenegro, Greece, Bulgaria, they all gang up together and they attack the Turks. And they set off the first Balkan War there. Turkish forces were defeated, and virtually the entire Balkan Peninsula was liberated from Ottoman control. And then Serbian forces, they then seized Kosovo and part of what is now Albania, parts of Albania, But then after pressure by several of the other countries and several of the European great powers, Serbia was forced to give up some of those territories, and an independent Albania was actually created at this time. However, Kosovo was still in Serbian hands, and Serbia nearly doubled in size as a result of its gains in the Balkan Wars.
But that's because of the Russian involvement, though, right?
Like, yeah,
they didn't do that on their own.
Yeah, well, yeah, Russian. It was, you know, Russia kind of was their kind of negotiating on their behalf.
Right.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Now, the next major event that happens, we all know what this event is. It's Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated by Serb nationalists, a Serbian nationalist group in Sarajevo. Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia in July to start World War I. Serbia actually puts up a pretty good fight against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, despite being a very poor country. Serbia was considered the poorest country in Europe at this time. And they had a small population, but they had a really good officer corps. They had a very good military school in Belgrade. So they actually were winning battles in the beginning of the war against a much larger army. But they eventually lose because Bulgaria turns against them. Bulgaria joins the Central Powers, and they're trying to actually retake land it lost in another conflict called the Second Balkan War. There was multiple Balkan Wars in this time period.
So many.
Bulgaria lost some lands to Serbia. But as in tradition, back to World War I, the Serbian army makes their last stand in Kosovo. And many of the Serbs, they retreat across the northern mountains of Albania, and then they make it to the Adriatic Sea, and then they're actually evacuated by Allied warships. But lucky for them, the Allies end up winning the war.
Or unlucky for them, because the entire region ends up going to total chaos.
Yeah, well, the next couple of decades are pretty bad, but they're bad for everyone in Europe after the war. So after World War I and after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, there's a multinational state of Yugoslavia that's patched together. And the initial name of this is called the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. They annex old Austro-Hungarian lands. They annex Slovenia and Croatia. They were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire previously. And then they also annexed the ethnically Croatian and Serbian lands of Bosnia, Montenegro, Macedonia, and then also Kosovo. And these nationalities, they coexisted in a state of mutual hostility, which provokes a royal dictatorship by King Alexander in 1929, where the name is actually officially changed to the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. And during this time period, there was a large-scale effort to settle Serbs in Kosovo in an effort to start diluting the ethnic Albanian majority in the region. But this royal dictatorship, it sparks even more resentment from other nationalities, and it leads to the assassination of King Alexander in 1934 by the pro-Bulgarian Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization. Say that five times fast.
Pro-Bulgarian Internal... Nope, not going to happen. Pro-Bulgarian Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization. Pro-Bulgarian Internal Macedonian Revolutionary... No.
You got it. Words. All right. Yeah. And to make things more confusing is that this group was allegedly financed by fascist Italy over their own interest in Albania.
This was actually that the first assassination that was caught on camera, and it was crazy.
Yeah, we actually about this
reviewed that on our last episode on Bosnia, I think it was, right?
Yeah, when we did our episode on the Bosnian War, we spoke about this. It was the first. We actually played some of the clips in it. It's interesting. Just it's the first assassination caught on camera. It's canned camera.
Oh, and
you
King
won't
Alexander
believe
has
what
been
happens
shot.
To this king.
King Alexander has been shot. The crowds want to kill the gunmen.
He's been shot. The royal wedding has been quite a disaster. We now go back to our programming. Okay, another thing that's really interesting about this, I don't want to forget this, Mussolini. So Italy has heavy interest in Albania due to, mainly because, if you look at Italy on a map, if you look at Albania on a map,
right,
and they're right next to each other.
Yeah, they're right across
the water. They're close. They're right across the water. So, they saw Albania as like a strategic port city, or not a port city, but a place. They had strategic ports there that helped them, control the Adriatic Sea. And then, Italian fascists, they claim that Albanians were linked through some ethnic heritage to Italians because, Rome once governed the region. Another story of the state using historians to, justify annexing or influence in some territory.
Yep.
But this leads to Italy's eventual occupation of Albania in 1939, right before the World War II breaks out. And then, when World War II does break out, Germany invades Yugoslavia in April of 1941, and the Yugoslavian army, it collapses in about 10 days. And what the Axis powers do is they transfer Kosovo to Albania. And Kosovo becomes this site of very intense fighting and horrible crimes against humanity among a bunch of different actors. So, the main forces that you have there in this war, this war that's this smaller war in World War II, because I guess you can kind of look at World War II as a bunch of like big wars going on at the same time.
Right, smaller theaters popping up here and there.
Smaller theaters pretty much everywhere in the world, but you have Serbian royalists who are loyal to the monarchy there, and then you have the communist partisans who were the most successful group there, and then you had German and Italian occupation forces, and then you have the ethnic Albanian groups that were allied with the Germans and Italians, and many of these Albanian nationalists were actually part of the 21st Waffen Mountain Division of the SS, and they allegedly unleashed very brutal ethnic cleansing campaigns on Serbs and Jews in Kosovo and in Bosnia. Hmm. So this brings us to Tito, who ends up being the dominant group in Kosovo after the war are the communist partisans under Joseph Broz Tito. And Tito makes Kosovo an autonomous province within Serbia, and then Serbia being the largest republic in the new socialist federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Unhappy with this arrangement, the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, they start pushing for Kosovo to become its own republic on par with Serbia. Now, in 1974, and we touched on this in our last episode, but Yugoslavia adopts a new constitution. The new constitution gave Kosovo, in many respects, de facto republic status, therefore an equal footing with Serbia, and ethnic Albanians, they took over leading post in the local government and then also within the economy. Mm-hmm. And Kosovo, it starts to receive large subsidies as part of a federal plan to equalize the differences income disparity. You know, they're trying to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor areas.
Did the Albanians in Kosovo ever try to, like, just make a thing with Albania prior, though?
Yeah, well, that we're going to get into that. So some did, but here's the thing. Most of them prefer to be part of Yugoslavia because most of the ethnic Albanians wanted to be part of they prefer to be part of Yugoslavia because they were freer there and they had a higher standard of living as part of Yugoslavia, because Albania in the 1970s was the poorest country in Europe. Hmm. They had a very brutal communist regime, and they were freer in Yugoslavia. I mean, despite, you know, we were talking about this last when we in our last episodes, but
yeah,
Yugoslavia was a communist country, but they were kind of a quasi communist country. They had a lot more levels of they were a lot more open than, you know, the Soviet Union, for example, or other communist countries. They had, you know, forms of privatizations of different industries, right, and things like that. So they, the economy had, was better.
Yeah, they also had, like, higher standard of living, as you said, like, more, like, literacy rates and, like, better, like, they had free education and free healthcare and, like, a bunch of, like, perks and shit for living there. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it would make sense, you know, to just want to stick with that, but that didn't last very long, did it?
Yeah. So, well, the reason it doesn't last very long is when the government gives privileges to one ethnic group over another, it usually causes resentment.
Well, I think that rule applies to pretty much everything, right?
I mean, it really does apply. I mean, think about this. Let's just say if you have two kids and then you give one kid special treatment and the other kid nothing, you neglect the other kid. The other kid's probably going to have some form of resentment. And I think the same rule applies if you, you know, favor some ethnic group over another one.
Mm-hmm.
It just causes nationalism rise on the other side. And, you know, nationalism was rising among ethnic Albanians. The resentment of the Serb minority in Kosovo at the, you know, Albanization of Kosovo, it increased. So Serbs were saying that they were being discriminated against by the Albanians. And they were even saying that they are being ethnically cleansed. And if you look at statistics, there is a clear shift in the demographics of Kosovo at this time. And wrote this down. In 1961, Serbs made up 23.6% of Kosovo's population. And then in 1998, right before the war breaks out, they were under 10% of the population.
Okay, so like a 13.6% drop. Was this like a forced cleansing, or did the Serbians just leave on their own accord for some reason?
Well, I think that answer is different on based on who you ask.
Okay, I guess so, yeah.
I think if you ask the you know, Albanians, they'll be like, no, they left for economic reasons. And then, you know, the Serbians will say, hey, no, you were ethnically cleansed there. Hmm. Let's fast forward this because we still got to get into the war.
Yeah, well, so the truth is that there was a shift in demographic population, right? Like, nobody disagrees with that, right?
Yes. So after Tito's death in 1980, the decentralized political system he put in place gradually began to fail. And there were increasingly open power struggles within Yugoslav's political elite. And Albanian nationalism was still very strong. So you know, there's a student protest at Pristina University that escalates into a riot. And protesters at this university, they actually started calling for republic status for Kosovo. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some demonstrators were even calling for a union with Albania, like you had mentioned earlier. But this riot was put down, you know, allegedly pretty brutally by the Yugoslav police, resulting in, you know, several deaths. But I guess these riots, what they ultimately do is they reinforce the fears that ethnic Albanians wanted to secede from Yugoslavia, you know, with the territory of Kosovo. So more Serbs started calling for the reassertion of control of Kosovo. And this is where you have Slobodan Milosevic come in. During a visit to Kosovo in April of 1987, a Serbian Communist Party official named Slobodan Milosevic, he gives this very rousing nationalistic speech to Serbs in Kosovo. And basically, the speech was, I'm paraphrasing it, but he was saying, hey, listen, like, you don't have to be abused by those Albanians anymore. I have your back. You know, we're going to, the government here in Yugoslavia is going to make sure that the Albanians don't get away with their crimes and stuff like that.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing it, but essentially it was kind of like a rousing speech that was catering to the Serb minority there. And this speech, it launches his political career, well, his career as a major political figure at the very least, and he's later on elected president of Serbia. And over the next 2 years, there's a number of laws that are passed that limit Kosovo's autonomy. So he encouraged Serbs to settle in Kosovo through jobs and financial incentives. Albanian government jobs were replaced by Serbs. Just, you know, ethnic nepotism at its worst. Milosevic is a humongous scumbag. Now, the destruction of Kosovo's autonomy, what it does is it provokes unease in other republics of Yugoslavia. They fear that they could potentially be the next victims of Milosevic's nationalistic policies. And for this reason, a lot of analysts will say that his moves in Kosovo lit the fuse that eventually resulted in the larger breakup of Yugoslavia, because the other republics were like, hey, you know, if he's going to crack down on Kosovo like this, he could crack down like this, crack down on us like this. So maybe we should get out of this union. So there's other reasons too. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but you know, that's what some analysts will say about the breakup. Now, he concedes Slovenia pretty quickly. There's like a brief conflict, but he does concede Slovenia. But then it escalates in Croatia because there's more Serbs in Croatia. But meanwhile, ethnic Serbs joined with Yugoslavian troops to seize about one-third of Kosovo. Now, you know, feeling that autonomy within Yugoslavia was no longer a viable option, ethnic Albanians, they held a referendum on independence for Kosovo. And independence was approved by their underground parliament in 1991. So just to give you a little bit of context on underground parliament, they when a lot of these kind of Serb favoritist policies were set in by Milosevic, there was a government, there was a parallel government that was created that was underground. Like they had, the Albanians created their own like underground parliament, and you know they voted on this, and the people who were relieved from their post, they formed this government. Now, a guy named Ibrahim Rugova is the leader of the Democratic League of Kosovo. He was later elected president, but the parallel parliament and government were prevented from actually functioning in Kosovo by Serbian police. So this is when the Albanians started looking to the international community to get some sort of political resolve. However, you know, there is political resolve going somewhere right now, but it's focused on Bosnia. At this time, the Bosnian War is wrapping up. The Dayton Peace Agreement in 1995 that ends the Bosnian War, it doesn't touch Kosovo. It doesn't involve Kosovo at all. So this leads to, in 1996, a group called the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, and they come to public after claiming responsibility for killing several Serbian policemen along with some other government officials. And in response, the Serb police, they were angered by the death of their comrades. They allegedly launched this massive assault on a village in an Albanian village where the Serbian police, killed and massacred a bunch of people. So what this ultimately does, it causes blowback. Because a lot of ethnic Albanians were outraged by what they saw was a systemic campaign to eradicate Albanians, and this causes more Albanians to join the KLA.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the KLA was on the U.S. State Department list of terrorist organizations.
So that part I didn't actually know, which I find very fascinating.
And I'll get more into the details about the KLA, because I think you'll find a lot of this interesting. But why don't we jump into the U.S. intervention and how that all happens?
Sure. Yeah, I can take this. So the Operation Allied Force began somewhere around March of 1999. And after about a year of effort by the international community that was led by NATO to find a negotiated solution in Kosovo, basically in June of 98, NATO defense ministers decided to charge NATO planners with the responsibility to produce a military strategy that, in case the diplomatic processes fail. According to Human Rights Watch, and I'll just read from them real quickly. So by the fall, an estimated 250,000 Kosovo Albanians had been driven from their homes, and some 50,000 were threatened by approaching winter weather. The United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution 1199 on September 23rd, highlighting the impending human catastrophe and demanding a ceasefire and the start of a real political dialogue. A contact group meeting in London on October 8th gave U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke a mandate to secure the agreement to the requirements of UNSCR 1199 in a mission to Belgrade. Activation orders for airstrikers were agreed on October 13th, the same day Holbrooke reported to NATO that Slobodan Milosevic, president of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, had agreed to the deployment of unarmed Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE. Oh yeah, I remember them. Verification mission to Kosovo and to the establishment of a NATO aerial verification mission. Yugoslavia also agreed to reduce their numbers of security forces personnel in Kosovo to pre-crisis levels. Despite the initial stabilization, violence continued following a massacre in the village of Rakak on January 15, 1999. NATO increased its state of readiness, issuing a solemn warning to Milosevic and the Kosovo-Albanian leadership on January 28th. This was followed by a second statement on January 30th that reaffirmed NATO's original demands and delegated to Security General Javier Solana authority to commence airstrikes against targets on FRI territory. Parties to talks at Rambouillet in France in February of 99 attempted to build agreements to protect the rights of all sides. After the first round of talks was suspended on February 23rd, a second round was convened on March 15th. The second round was suspended on March 19th in the light of what NATO intelligence and OSCE observers saw as intensifying violence on the ground, instigated by FRI security forces and a buildup of FRI Serbian forces in and around Kosovo. OSCE verifiers were withdrawn during the night of March 19th to 20th. And Holbrooke flew to Belgrade on March 22nd in a last-ditch effort to persuade Milosevic to back down and avoid a military confrontation. On March 23rd, following final consultations with allies, Javier Solana directed NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, General Wesley Clark, to initiate a phased air operation. So, yeah, that's what the Human Rights Watch says about that. It's pretty fascinating, actually. How many times they try to talk it out before they actually went with, military action.
Well, you know, Milosevic, he absolutely was a very brutal autocrat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he regularly murdered and repressed his political opponents. But that being said, he becomes a perfect target for NATO. You know, when NATO is usually when they're looking for a new Hitler, kind of like a Saddam Hussein.
Yep. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. But he does kind of fill like that Gaddafi part. He's like this kind of, he's like a mafia scumbag. He's a mafia scumbag nationalist who obviously has clear kind of discriminatory policies against one group. And, he can't be reasoned with. And,
right, and he's just a dick.
If you look at, like, articles from antiwar.com, from, like, peace activists, they're like, oh, my God, this guy is such an idiot. Like, this guy is the worst cause for the anti-war movement ever because he's such a moron, this guy is, and such a complete, like, just jackass. And he just undermines us trying to... Like, he's the worst enemy of us trying to, like, say that we shouldn't intervene in this conflict because he's just such a dopey idiot. But I think it's important to look at the whole picture and, why NATO said that they intervene. Here's an excerpt from a report by Dick Marty of the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe's investigative team looking into war crimes. So the appalling crimes committed by Serbian forces, which stirred up very strong feelings worldwide, gave rise to a mood reflected as well in the attitude of certain international agencies, according to which it was invariably one side that were regarded as the perpetrators of crimes, and the other side of the victims thus necessarily innocent. The reality is less clear-cut and more complex. So, just to go back, on March 24th, 1999, a U.S.-NATO intervention was launched under the Responsibility to Protect Clause, and it was asserted mainly by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. And for 78 days, NATO targeted what is, then called the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, what they were called after the Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia. They were bombing them over, alleged atrocities against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Mm-hmm. And I know this is confusing. The Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was just Serbia and Montenegro. Mm-hmm. It was the country that was created after the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia dissolved in the early 1990s. But the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia splits into Serbia and Montenegro in 2003. But NATO drops 23,000 bombs and they kill around. Well, Human Rights Watch concludes that as few as 489 and as many as 528 civilians died in the bombings. I don't know the exact... I've seen the larger figures, but... Human Rights Watch is, they're kind of a mixed bag sometimes.
Yeah.
They do some good reporting. They do some not good reporting. They're a mixed bag. Every intervention, there was a very big push from the state and the media to justify the intervention. Here's where things get very weird in the U.S. media landscape and also the British landscape. So Secretary of Defense William Cohen, he told CBS News on Face the Nation, we've now seen about 100,000 military-aged men missing. They may have been murdered. And then this is from The Guardian. They may have been murdered. David Sheffer, the U.S. envoy for war crimes issues, put the figure even higher. He told reporters at NATO headquarters on May 18th last year that more than 225,000 ethnic Albanian men between the ages of 14 and 59 were unaccounted for. Madeleine Albright was one of the big pushers of the war. And then, you know, back in, and I think it's important to note, so in the 90s, CNN was almost had like a monopoly on like the international cable news universe. Christine Amanpour, she was the given the leading role in reporting on the Kosovo war, and her husband James Rubin was a spokesperson for Madeleine Albright. And Madeleine Albright, she's the sicko who went on 60 Minutes and said that, hey, when they were saying, hey, over 500,000 children died in Iraq due to the sanctions placed on them. She's like, yeah, it was fine. It was worth it.
Wow.
And we think it was worth it.
Yeah. Wow.
Which, you know, which caused a lot of people to say, hey, maybe I should join a group like Al-Qaeda. That would actually, that's how mad I am about that. But, you know, these people, the media and the State Department, you know, they work together, they live together, and they often marry each other. often date and marry each other and become families. And then, you know, the British press was really bad, too. You know, Tony Blair was invoking the Holocaust. Even Bernie Sanders was supportive of the intervention. One of his aides actually resigned because of Bernie's support.
I found pretty fascinating. I didn't actually know that.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance Podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, well, it was a Democrat war, you know what I mean? So usually a lot of people just fall in line. What's interesting is that I forgot who said this, and I read this somewhere, but there was people saying that, hey, like, we need to intervene in Kosovo because Albania and Kosovo, they could threaten Italy. They're right across, they're, you know, whatever, 60 miles away in the Adriatic Sea or so. I'm not sure what the distance is. I'm just guessing 60 miles away. You know, there could be a threat to Italy. Almost like when Ronald Reagan said that the Sandinistas could be a threat to Texas.
Right.
Like that kind of logic. Like they're going to invade Italy or something. Like, what?
Yeah,
I'm not going to invade Italy.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Now, in reality, I'm just going to be blunt. All this was complete and utter horseshit. Like, these were lies. So, contrary to NATO, they claimed that... So, NATO's claim was 100,000 or more Albanians were massacred by Serbians.
Mm-hmm.
And then post-war investigators, they found that fewer than 5,000 people died. 1,500 of which happened after NATO occupied Kosovo. And these were due to pogroms by the Albanians. And a lot of these war crimes were committed by the KLA. So the Kosovo Liberation Army. So here's a interesting quote that I highlighted from Clint Williamson of the EU Special Investigative Task Force in regards to reports that they released on war crimes. He told reporters, certain elements of the KLA intentionally targeted the minority populations with acts of persecution that included unlawful killings, abductions, and forced disappearances, aliens in camps in Kosovo and Albania, sexual violence, other forms of inhumane treatment, forced displacement of individuals from their homes and communities, and desecration and destruction of churches and other religious sites. So this special investigative task force was set up in response to a book that was published by the former chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal. Her name is Carla DuPont, she's an Italian, and the book's titled "The Hunt," which the book claims that there was compelling evidence indicating that KL leaders had engaged in the trafficking of human organs obtained from prisoners of war. So you want to read some? I'll read some. Or you want to read some of this book? I sent some of the book over to you. Or do you want me to read it?
Yeah, I can read it. Yeah.
Sure. All right. Okay, so, I highlighted this.
Yeah, I see it. Okay. So the prosecutor's office received information which UNMIK officials had received from a team of trustworthy journalists that during the summer months of 1999, Kosovo Albanians had transported 300 kidnapped people from Kosovo to Albania. These prisoners were initially held in sheds and other structures in the Kukës and Tripogji. According to the journalist sources, who were only identified as Kosovo Albanians, some of the younger and fitter prisoners were visited by doctors and were never hit. They were transferred to the other detention camps in Burrell and neighboring area, one of which was a barracks behind a yellow house 20 kilometers behind the town. One room inside this yellow house, the journalist said, was kitted out as a makeshift operating theater, and it was here that the surgeons transplanted the organs of prisoners. These organs, according to sources, were then sent to Rinas Airport, Tirana, to be sent to the surgical clinics abroad and to be transplanted to paying patients. One of the informers had personally carried out a shipment to the airport. The victims, deprived of a kidney, were then locked up again inside the barracks until the moment they were killed for other vital organs. In this way, the other prisoners in the barracks were aware of the fate that awaited them and, according to the source, pleaded, terrifying, to be killed immediately. Among the prisoners who were taken to these barracks were women from Kosovo, Albania, Russia, and other Slavic countries. Two of the sources say that they helped them bury the corpses of the dead around the Yellow House and in a neighboring cemetery. According to the sources, the organ smuggling was carried out with the knowledge and active involvement of a middle and high-ranking involvement from the KLA. That's fucking nuts. That reads like a horror like novel. That's crazy.
So
shit,
the KLA was like an organized crime syndicate that like was involved in heroin dealing and drug smuggling and human trafficking
and kidney shit
and organ harvesting.
That's
so it was like crazy. It was just a complete criminal organization of thugs. Man, have you been watching Squid Games?
I saw the whole thing. Yeah.
So, all right, I'm sorry. I'm going to spoil some of it. I think this only happens in the fourth
episode.
It's
been long enough. I think you can spoil it.
It's been long enough, and I'm not going... I'm actually only into episode four or five, wherever this part of the plot takes place. And it's very intense for me, honestly. It's hard for me to watch. I enjoy it, but I can't watch it in doses because I find it, like, kind of horrifying. I don't know if you had the same. Like, the whole story of just people
I'm into that shit. So like I remember watching Battle Royale, which was super similar concept, and I guess Hunger Games is like that too. So like I'm pretty desensitized.
Hunger Games
to
disturbed
this shit.
me. the plot of the Hunger Games like truly disturbed me. I was like, man, this is really fucked up. Like, I can't.
Yeah, the idea is kind of fucked up. I'm not gonna lie, but it doesn't faze me as much, and I just like watch it at face value. But this was pretty cool. I liked it. I really did. But I think I know where you're going with this about the organ harvesting.
Yeah. So I guess now you don't spoil anything for me because I'm only halfway through. But you know, everyone knows by now is about a game that people are in debt. People with massive amounts of debt do these challenges. Like, what the hell was that show? What was that Japanese show called where like people had these crazy challenges?
Which one? There's a number of Japanese game shows like that.
The one that they like started replaying on Spike TV and they dubbed over it.
Oh, like Takeshi's Castle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that, yeah. But like you die when you mess up.
I think the Spike TV version was MX Live or some shit like that.
Yeah, yeah. Something that was like such that. A ridiculous show. The person who came up with that was a genius. Because that was so funny. But yeah, it's that. But they when you mess up, you die. But I guess in a couple episodes in, they find out that, you know, some of the people are organ harvesting, the people who die. That's what it reminds me of. That just came to mind because I've been watching it. But yeah, it's sick. They were like a truly brutal group. Now to pull this back to our episode on Bosnia, and I didn't talk about this in our last episode. I probably should have brought this up in our last episode, but I thought it'd be better to speak about it in the context of Kosovo. We all know that the United States fostered Islamist militant groups in the 1980s to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan.
Right.
Very few people know that the U.S. was backing Islamic militants for a second time in the 1990s. So following the Russian withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989 and the collapse of their puppet regime in 1992, many of the Islamist fighters there were left with nothing to do. And, you know, they were provided with a new cause in the Balkans. And the Clinton administration gave the green light to not only Saudi Arabia, but Iran as well, along with, you know, the various radical Islamic charities to arm the Bosnian Muslims. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, the uncle of Ramzi Youssef,
KSM? You know,
KSM, uncle of Ramzi Youssef, the bomb maker in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and also just one of the main architects of 9/11, he got his stripes fighting in Bosnia.
You know, I think I remember you saying that when we were talking about 9/11, and I'd never made that connection. That's crazy.
Yeah, because I think he didn't fight in Afghanistan, so he got his stripes fighting in Bosnia. And a lot of other bin Ladenites, you know, got their training and got their first battle experience and fighting in the conflicts there. And then, you know, I mentioned before, in 1998, the KLA was already listed by the State Department as a terrorist organization. You know, they allegedly had financial ties with bin Laden and you know, the heroin trade. So Ayman Zawahiri, his brother was actually, he was in the KLA, or he led a KLA unit. And, you know, allegedly he had direct radio contact with NATO leadership. So
I could believe that, man. I feel like we set all that shit up.
So, just like you're just left with, like, what? What the fuck? But, yeah. You know, why the Balkans? And, you know, we went over this in our last episode, man. Like, what was the real reason for the intervention in NATO? I mean, I guess you could go. I mean, at the very best, you can say, hey, man, like, there was a conflict in Serbia, and these people were going to be ethnically cleansed. And, you know, we were just at the Scott Horton debate against Bill Kristol. And then someone asked him at the end they asked, he was asked a question saying, what conflict was worth it, or what was a successful intervention. And Bill Kristol said, Kosovo.
Yeah.
And then Scott Horton was like, kind of like, what? And that was the end of the debate. And but I guess maybe you can kind of sort of look at the humanitarian angle of it and say, hey, man, like, we're not making this up about Milosevic. Milosevic was a pretty terrible person, and there was definitely I don't want to say there were definitely massacres and ethnic cleansing among Albanians. So I know a guy. I have an Albanian friend who's who his grandfather was assassinated during this time period, and he's actually kind of this guy is I would say he's kind of like I don't want to call him a conservative or anything like that. He's not a conservative, but he's like red-pilled, you know. He would call himself red-pilled, who's like, you know, super into reading about scandals and hates the Clintons and stuff. And not saying hating the Clintons make you red-pilled, because there's a lot of idiots who hate the Clintons too, but, you know, he's somebody who's kind of up to date on stuff and doesn't buy like all the corporate press narrative. But he said to me, he's like, the one thing that I like about the Clintons is that they intervened in Kosovo. Because those Serbians were going to kill all of us. And, you know, you obviously can't blame him. His grandfather was assassinated there.
Right.
Like, his grandfather was murdered. So, of course, he's going to, you know, when you speak to people who have, like, you know, victims in their family victims, you know, you can kind of create that justification to intervene, because, you know, there definitely were atrocities. It's just, you know, what does the intervention actually cost? And then are there actors who are trying to exaggerate the Serb atrocities in order to justify the intervention? Because remember, you know, the major theme of our last episode on the Yugoslav wars was that NATO was the historical precedent was set or changed for NATO, because NATO was a defensive organization and it became an offensive organization. And, you know, we kind of ended our last episode with Bosnia, was that, you know, NATO kind of became an occupying force in Bosnia, and where, you know, they don't even really control their government. There's a, you know, a high commissioner who basically can control the Bosnian government by fiat, or make decisions in the Bosnian government by fiat. So they're kind of just like an occupied territory with NATO in control. So it kind of sets the precedent of NATO becoming an offensive organization, rather than what it was intended to do, was be a bulwark against the Soviet Union and, you know, protect countries from, you know, some huge red invasion if that were to happen. But, you know, here's an interesting story, and I think this will be something really interesting to end on. I want to bring up General Sir Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson.
So he actually had a reason. So I have a quote from him. So we will certainly stay here. Well, he was a commander of NATO troops in the region. We will certainly stay here for a long time in order to guarantee the safety of the energy corridors which cross Macedonia. The general was talking about the Trans-Balkan pipeline passing through Bulgaria, Macedonia, and Albania, planned to be be a primary route to the west for Central Asian oil and gas. So, I mean, was this about pipelines? You know, probably. You're like, probably what was pipelines, like the money interest and like the big politic corporate interest in all of this? And you're like, well, there were big pipeline projects. Are you still with me?
Yeah, no, I am, and I totally agree. I think it definitely has to do with oil, 100%.
Sir, I want to end with Sir Michael Jackson, because he actually may have saved the world from utter annihilation.
So the King of Pop saved the world? Amazing.
Well, in the closing days of the fighting, Moscow dispatched a peacekeeping force without prior authorization from Western powers. Russia had expected to receive a peacekeeping sector independent of NATO, and then they were pushed out of the loop, and they were very angry about this. So they went ahead and did it anyway. So they sent peacekeeping forces to an airport, and NATO's supreme commander at the time, U.S., and you guys will probably know Wesley Clark. Wesley Clark is the guy that he was interviewed, and then he said that he received this memo about conquering seven nations. Mm-hmm. And he was like, man, I got a memo saying that we were going to do a regime change in Iraq and Syria and Iran and Lebanon, like seven nations. He was a NATO supreme commander, and he ordered General Michael Jackson, Sir General Michael Jackson, to seize the airport outside of Kosovo's capital, Pristina, and prevent the Russian troop planes from landing by force. And Sir Michael Jackson, he said, I'm not starting World War III for you.
I'm not going to start World War III for you, baby.
That's ignorant.
That's ignorant.
No bombs.
I'm not going to do it. Hee
No, my little blanket.
Jamona.
No. I'm not going to start World War III for you. Let's all get along and not fight over Yugoslavia. Look at me.
We are
Look
the
at
world.
Me. Just hold hands.
We are the Yugoslavia.
No bombs.
Wow. I didn't know Michael Jackson saved the world. That's amazing. I didn't know Michael Jackson was a sir either. That's amazing. I believe it now. King of Pop, knighted by the Queen, saved the world from World War III. I believe it all. Crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, there it is. That's our episodes on Yugoslavia.
Dude, that was fascinating, man. And I'll just return to what I said earlier on in the show. I think, again, even in this episode, you know, you heard crazy shit from like ancient ties to like fucking ethnic divides to religious divides to changing political affiliations from like communism to capitalism, from autocracies to democracies, like fucking everything. We've seen NATO involvement, we've seen Russian involvement, we had parts of the of World War One, World War Two, the Cold War, fucking terrorists, organ don't like harvesting. Like, there's so many things that happened in this period. Too many things, honestly. But
yeah, it's just a really, really just crazy story. And we've only just, you know, if you're listening right now, we just gave you basically a high, like, these are high level overview. This is a high level overview. Like, you know, we're not pretending like we're doing like this super detailed historical analysis of everything and, you know, using a million different sources. We're definitely, this show is meant to give high level overviews and, you know, comment on them and try to learn and generate real just interest in this. So, you know, people want to continue learning about this stuff because it's so damn fascinating. So this was the third episode, and I guess we can call this a series about the breakup of Yugoslavia. Let us know if you'd like us doing like series like this, because we certainly have other ideas in mind. One of the next ones is the Korean War that, you know, I've been reading books on, and I think that we could fit the Korean War into like a three-part series type thing because it's, you know, another thing, another situation that's not, you know, it's the forgotten war for a reason. So let us know if you want us to do something like that. And of course, we'll kind of sprinkle in other episodes like, you know, that are currently, you know, like our usual, hot. Like doing current hot topics, hot things.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to wrap this thing up?
Yeah, man.
All right. Today it's New Year's Eve right now. It's December 31st. So happy New Year's, everyone. I know that will be belated because we're going to release this episode on Monday. I think that's going to be our new schedule going forward. Monday mornings, we're going to get back to our weekly schedule of releasing episodes. If you want to support this show, make sure that you rate and review the podcast. That is the number one way to rate this show. And attention, if you guys are listening to this show on Spotify. So if you are listening to this show on Spotify, you can now rate the podcast on Spotify. So if you're listening on Spotify, in a top, I think, left-hand corner of your Spotify app, you're going to be able to rate the podcast. So rate and review Bro History 5 stars. We want to get that. We want to beef that up. I don't know how that affects SEO or shit like that with Spotify. Most of our listens come from iTunes, but yeah, we want to bump that up. So
certainly can't hurt
if you listen to Spotify. If you like this show and you want to support us and you're listening on Spotify, rate and review the podcast. It will be a tremendous help to the show. And then also, we have our Patreon. You can join. You get access to our Slack. And our Slack is a very fun community where we really just continue the discussions of this podcast. And we have a lot of cool people on there who bring a lot of great insight on there. So join our Patreon to get access to Slack. And yeah. Anything else, Danny?
No, man.
All right. Happy New Year, guys. And RIP guys. Betty. And RIP Betty White. I just learned that she died.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.